Arthur Holmwood and Quincy Morris hadn't believed it, insisting that it was the work of grave robbers. Van Helsing and Seward had been awake all night. Surely they didn't know what they saw. They couldn't possibly have seen her. And yet they had seen her. Van Helsing remained stone-faced and unmoved, per usual. He insisted that Lucy was now a member of the undead. Their only choice? Cut off her head, fill her mouth with garlic, and put a stake through her heart. Dr. Seward announced that he knew how they all felt. She might not have said yes to him, but he had loved Lucy as much as the other two men. The thought of her being mutilated, it made him sick. But he also knew what he saw. They had seen her, and they saw the child. She wasn't Lucy anymore. And if he let her continue, so many more would die. Many children. Arthur and Quincy didn't respond. Seward begged them to at least come to the graveyard that night. They had to see for themselves. And see they did. Arthur and Quincy canceled their plans. And sometime around 4 a.m., the men made their way to the tomb. "Isn't that technically sacrilege?" Arthur asked as he watched Van Helsing lay consecrated communion wafers all over the door to Lucy's tomb. The professor rolled his eyes. "Hide," he told them. It was nearly sunrise when they heard it. It wasn't Lucy. It was a child. Arthur looked at Seward, but the man redirected his gaze toward the scene. He needed to see this. He needed to know what was necessary. It was Lucy, clad in white, the same dress they had buried her in. She seemed to glide over the ground as she set the child down and continued toward her tomb. The sun was rising. She stopped at the door, grimaced, hands holding her head as if she was in pain. A noise from behind caught her attention. She spun around, and the hopeful, half-smiling face of Arthur morphed into one of horror. She wasn't Lucy. She had changed. Her eyes burned like hellfire, and her mouth was smothered in blood. He looked into her eyes, searching. He wanted so badly for it to be her, for her to be alive. She smiled in understanding and beckoned him over. She hungered for him. They could go inside and rest together. Arthur took a step. "All right, that's enough," Van Helsing shouted, emerging from his cover. Lucy screeched and flew back, away from the crucifix he held out toward her. She was pinned between the Eucharist and the crucifix, staring at Van Helsing with a hate none of the men who had truly known her in life thought she was capable of showing. Van Helsing stepped around her and collected the communion wafers from the door. Instantly, Lucy sneered at them all and moved through it, just before the first sunlight hit the graveyard. Van Helsing replaced the communion wafers around the door, and then all around the tomb. He was sorry Arthur had to experience that. But did he see? Did he now understand what was necessary? Arthur was already halfway to picking up the child. When he did it, he noticed the pair of marks on the boy's neck, and remembered the blood on Lucy's lips. He held the child close. He was pale and shivering in the night. Arthur nodded. He understood. He would do it. I'm Jason Weiser. From Bardic, this is Fictional. Jonathan shuddered. He remembered everything. He remembered the team of Romani workers that the Count hired to take the boxes of dirt in the basement. Jonathan's hands shook as he remembered the terror. He had shouted at the workers to take the money, to take the letters. Please, get them to Mina. They did take the money and the letters. And they gave the letters to the Count. That night at dinner, Jonathan found the letters opened, his shorthand to Mina on display. The Count was oddly friendly, and said that these scribbles, whatever they were obviously a mistake, and so he burned them all. Later that evening, Jonathan returned to his room to find all of his clothes gone. Later, a woman wailed outside the base of the castle, her cries pulling him from his thoughts. She stood, begging to have her child back. Dracula had stood from his own balcony, dressed in Jonathan's clothes, and cursed her. right before calling the wolves. Jonathan closed his journal abruptly and set it down. Now that he remembered the sound of the woman and the wolves, he would never forget it. His thoughts continued, and Jonathan remembered climbing down the wall and into Dracula's chambers the morning the Count was set to leave. He had seen the Count laying in a box, in a coffin. The man, or the thing, rather, slept in dirt, his eyes open, blood smeared on his mouth. But that wasn't what terrified Jonathan the most. No, it was that the Count was young. His wrinkled skin was smooth, and his white mustache and hair were now an inky black. At that moment, Jonathan heard a noise upstairs. He didn't care what the worker said. He would push past them and run for it. As he rushed up the stairs and rounded the corner of the Count's room to climb back up the wall, he knew he had made a horrible mistake. The workers were moving the Count. He rushed back down the stairs just as the door clicked shut. He pounded on it and screamed, but no one came. With the Count gone, there would be nothing to keep them at bay. The women, the ones who had killed that boy, he'd heard them in the night, laughing and whispering, biding their time. Come nightfall, they would come for him. If it was death now by plummeting from a wall, or death later being devoured by those creatures, Jonathan chose the option where he had a chance. He found Dracula's balcony, gripped the stones, and descended into the forest. The journal stopped at Jonathan's descent from the walls. His following weeks in the forest were shadowy and vague. Even he didn't know what happened before collapsing at the border crossing. Jonathan lowered his journal. Now that monster was here. And if Mina and her new friend, Dr. Van Helsing, were to be believed, he had already claimed his first victim. No more, Jonathan thought, shaking his head. This was his home. And England was entirely unprepared for the likes of Dracula. Right now, only he and a handful of people knew the danger the Count posed. They were the only ones who could stop him. Meanwhile, in Hampstead Heath, it was finished. Arthur was a mess. She didn't look like Lucy until after, but that was enough. He broke down after he finished putting the stake through her heart. Lucy's eyes had snapped open, her blood-smeared mouth screaming. She writhed and contorted, her mouth frothing with a red foam as Arthur hammered and hammered and hammered. The blood of dozens of children sprayed on the four men, but soon, Lucy fell still. She stopped screaming, and then she stopped moving. Van Helsing had to stop Arthur from hammering, and he pointed down at the corpse. The men gasped, and that was when Arthur broke down. It was hard to explain, but she looked like Lucy again. His Lucy. The professor told Arthur that he could kiss her now, if he wanted. He watched. Yeah, that was sweet. Okay, now please step back. Van Helsing, as he was vigorously jamming garlic in the now completely dead girl's mouth, said that everyone who had issues with watching him cut off her head should probably leave the tomb. It was about to get pretty real. Two nights and too many showers to count later, the four men sat around the table as Mina Harker entered the room. She was teary-eyed, but nodded and took a seat. She had been there for a couple of days. Seward's notes and journals were on phonograph, and Mina was transcribing them, in part to help the group when searching for any relevant information, and in part to learn what happened to her best friend, when none of the men would tell her, for fear of upsetting her delicate sensibilities. She had learned what happened, and made more copies of Jonathan's journal. If they were going to beat this thing, there needed to be no secrets between them. As such, they were all living at Seward's mental asylum now. It was a centralized, secure location, with enough rooms for everyone. What Seward hadn't realized before reading Mina's transcript of her husband's diary was just how strategic his hospital was. It sat right next door to the Carfax estate. Suddenly, Renfield's escapes to the estate became clear. His bizarre diary. The talk of the master. Van Helsing told Dr. Seward to sit down. He had made that connection a couple of days ago. He also guessed that Renfield's violent outbursts were in connection to the Count's proximity. Somehow, the man communed with the Count, had a connection with him. Mina stood. She had a request. She wanted to speak with Mr. Renfield. As memories came flooding back, Jonathan remembered the names he had seen on the Count's desk during one of the earlier nights at the castle. There were the names of three solicitors, both in and outside of England, and Jonathan stood before one right now, a Mr. Patterson. He introduced himself. He was Jonathan Harker, Esquire, owner of one of the most prestigious law firms in London. If that wasn't enough, he explained that they shared a mutual client, an Eastern European count who recently acquired an estate north of London. It turned out the ship carrying his cargo had run aground, and some of his boxes were missing, from Jonathan's late boss's portion at least. While he knew attorney-client privileged, but frowned on that sort of thing, it was so minor. Just a few boxes of dirt for some eccentric count. It was better for everyone if everything was in its place. Mr. Patterson hesitated momentarily, but nodded and stepped aside. Sure, Jonathan could look through the records, but be quick about it. Jonathan smiled and thanked the man. And, as he took notes, he learned the location of all the boxes of earth that the Count had shipped from Transylvania. These locations were the only places the Count had to hide. Oh my goodness, where are my manners? This place is a mess. Renfield stood next to a table full of spiders eating dead flies. Mina was about to say it wasn't a problem, when Renfield abruptly set to work, scooping up the flies and gulping them down in several meaty chews. The spiders came second and were, from the sound of it, significantly crunchier. He was polite enough to wait until he was done chewing and offered Dr. Seward and Mina a seat. Seward said they would be just fine standing, and Renfield pursed his lips. Ah, I see. Seward was still upset about the girl he loved dying. Was this young lady the new one? Seward shook his head and started to reply when... Wait, he never told Renfield about Lucy. With a sly grin, Renfield turned back to Mina and began talking, spouting off philosophy and psychology like a polished gentleman. Seward was stunned. Who was this guy? The trio chatted, and Mina steered conversation to the life-eater hypothesis, a topic which Renfield was happy to discuss. The patient laughed. He used to fancy that life was a positive and perpetual entity, and that by consuming life, he might indefinitely prolong his own. Once he even tried to kill the doctor here to test his hypothesis. But that was all in the past. Mina looked at the table, still sprinkled with an odd spider's leg or two. But Renfield just ate an entire table of insects. Renfield nodded. Yes. Yes, he did. And... Seward stood. They should go. Renfield needed his rest. Confused, Mina said she hoped to see him again under better circumstances. With a smile and sing-songy voice, Renfield called back that Mina was such a lovely young woman. He hoped to never see her sweet face ever again. May he bless and keep you. That night, Van Helsing called another meeting. It was time for some exposition. First off, he praised Mina for possessing a man's brain, which had helped them so much so far. Seward chimed in with a, "Hear, hear," but then quickly undercut his dubious praise with the hope that soon she might not have to be involved in fighting Dracula. It was no part for a woman. With all the casual sexism out of the way, Van Helsing explained exactly what they were up against. It was called the Nosferatu in German folklore, or the undead. A vampire. The creatures were immortal, possessed super strength, could command certain animals and elements, and could change form or vanish at will. Oh, and he could also command the dead. The group sat speechless. Oh, okay. Clearly defeating this thing would be super easy, Van Helsing continued. The monster wasn't without its weaknesses, however. As they probably guessed, it had to consume blood to survive. And, according to legend, they couldn't enter a house without first being invited in, though an open door or window constituted an invitation. The creatures lost their power at daybreak, forcing them to seek refuge in the earth of their homeland, or in a coffin, or, in Dracula's case, both, which was why they needed to know the exact location of the boxes. Dracula wasn't banking on needing just one box. He was planning on scattering them all over England to give himself multiple places of refuge. However, Nosferatu were also powerless against holy objects, such as crucifixes or consecrated communion wafers. Van Helsing stood before the group. He was old, and this would be the most dangerous thing he ever undertook. Sunshine, fair places, and the songs of birds were all far behind him. He knew he might be going to his death. But that was okay. He had enjoyed a good life, and the best end for him would be to rid the world of this evil. The young people before him, however, well, they had a lot to look forward to. So now was their chance. Before they went any farther, were they in or were they out? Seward said that he would follow his old mentor anywhere. Quincy and Arthur agreed that they would do it for their love of Lucy. Jonathan answered for himself and Mina. He had seen Dracula's power firsthand. It must be put to an end. Van Helsing nodded. Excellent. He was glad they were all on board. But they couldn't all take part in this. One had to stay behind. He turned to Mina and thanked her for doing more work than any of the men in the room to transcribe and connect all these disparate accounts. But she had to stay behind. After tonight, she could not question any of them. It was too dangerous. They were men and able to bear it. But she must be their star and their hope. And they would be able to act all the more freely if she were not in danger. Mina blinked. So, despite everything she had done and knew, she was, like, their cheerleader? Van Helsing nodded. Absolutely. And she had no choice in the matter. The men shook their heads. No, no, none at all. Mina rolled her eyes. Dr. Seward, Jonathan, Arthur, Quincy, and Van Helsing gripped their crucifixes with sweaty hands. It was early evening. The sun was in the sky, and he was powerless. They knew this, but still. This was Carfax. His home. They had no idea what traps he had set to keep himself safe during his daily sleep. Jonathan had made a map of the estate. His law firm had helped the Count purchase it. And as such, Jonathan also had a skeleton key that opened any door on the property. The previous night, after Mina went to bed, the men had crowded around the map, determining the best place. Each man had an envelope full of consecrated communion wafers bumping along in his pocket, just in case. I count 29, Quincy yelled to the others. He had just finished counting the boxes of earth for the second time. There were supposed to be more here, Jonathan murmured. It's nearly 60% of them in one stop, Jonathan, Van Helsing said, before motioning to Quincy to stop. The man was about to lay wafers on the boxes, making them effectively useless to Dracula. But Van Helsing insisted that this trip was for information only. They couldn't make a move until they were ready. He couldn't know what they knew, and... Wait, what was that? A low rumble sounded from below. Then, the floor moved. Jonathan kicked, Van Helsing stomped, and Quincy jumped up on one of the boxes. All of them screamed in disgust and terror as the floor came alive with hundreds of hungry rats. Quickly, Arthur lifted the whistle around his neck to his lips and blew. The mass of rats, which Stoker says was multiplying by the thousands, froze as they listened. Outside came barking. Nearly a quarter of the rats had fled by the time Arthur's hounds burst into the room. Those that remained didn't last long. Wait, I've never seen you with a dog, Quincy noted as he climbed down to the floor littered with dogs and way too many rat parts. You mean to tell me you have a pack of trained hounds roaming around the countryside that respond to your whistle at a moment's notice? Arthur nodded. Didn't everyone? The others shook their heads. Huh. Must just be a rich guy thing, then. Half an hour before sundown, the group emerged from Carfax, returned to Seward's office for a stiff drink and more planning before bed around midnight. Jonathan entered his room and saw the window was open. It was early October, and things were getting a bit chilly. He could see Mina, pale and a little cold to the touch in bed. He covered her, closed the window, and went to sleep. For Mina, it was more difficult not being in on everything. If she didn't talk about the count during the day, she saw that stark white face in her dreams, leaning over her. She awoke late the next morning and made her way to breakfast, where the men were already up and talking about coffins and dogs. When she entered the room, their conversation abruptly stopped. She didn't like this. How could her husband not talk to her about the most important thing in either of their lives? It was unbearable having to leave the room before her friends felt free enough to talk again. She did manage to overhear something about the final 21 boxes were in two houses in London, which the Count apparently bought under the very subtle and not at all on-the-nose name of Count Deville. At the very least, she was proud of her Jonathan. Not only had he recovered from his ordeal out east, but he was strong again. He was the man she had fallen in love with. Mina went to talk to Renfield. According to Dr. Seward, the man was a dangerous, devious mental patient. But anytime he talked to her, he seemed calm and level-headed. Dr. Seward even remarked on the positive effects Mina had on the patient, that if he weren't linked to an evil super vampire, Seward might actually have considered his release. Renfield had given up on the flies, spiders, and the sparrows. He told Seward and Mina that life-eating had put a terrible weight on him, and he was now worried about his soul. Mina held the key to his cell and opened it. Renfield smiled a greeting when he saw that it was Mina, and his smile melted when he saw her face. She could see that Seward had freed the man from his restraints on account of his good behavior. For some reason, he nearly wept when he saw Mina's face. Then, his sorrow turned to rage. He told her to get out, get away from him. He didn't want to see her again. He couldn't stand the look of her. Mina tried to calm him down, but the man advanced to the point where she no longer felt safe. Renfield wasn't well. She had read about the sparrows. Mina rushed from the room and slammed the door behind her. We'll see what happened later on that night, but that will be right after this. Here at Fictional, we love to read. Surprise! So I'm happy to announce the return of The Great American Read. It's a 7-part TV series and online event that has all of America talking about books. It's simple. PBS has a list of America's 100 best-loved novels, and they need you to help pick number one. So many of my favorites are on this list, too. Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, Tolkien's The Lord of the Rings, The Great Gatsby, A Game of Thrones, definitely, Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, and, of course, my all-time favorite novel, Dune. I'm so excited for this event, and I hope you join in, wherever you are. Voting's already underway. Just go to pbs.org, that's pbs.org, check out the amazing book list, and then vote for your favorites. Conversations are happening all over using hashtag GreatReadPBS. Join host Meredith Vieira and some of your favorite authors, celebrities, and athletes for a celebration of reading. Watch The Great American Read this fall, Tuesdays at 8, 7 Central. It's all starting September 11th on your PBS station. Tune in and discover if your favorite novel is voted as America's favorite book. Okay, so if you don't know what Bombas socks are, you're missing out because they figured out how to take actual clouds and knit them together for your feet. And I'm getting a head shake from Carissa. Apparently I can't say that because it's not true and also physically impossible. Well, okay, so they feel like you're wearing clouds on your feet. You know how you never think about your socks? Get ready to start thinking about your socks in the best way possible. You'll just be sitting there, amazed that socks can be this comfortable. They have stay-up technology, an arch support system, and super soft cotton that makes you never want to take them off. For real. They sent me some, but I had to buy more. They were just that good. I got some for Carissa so she could feel the wonder that is Bombas. They seriously are the most comfortable socks in the history of feet. Go to bombas.com/fictional and use the code fictional for 20% off your first order. That's bombas.com/fictional, code fictional, and you'll get 20%. Yeah, 20% off your first order. All right, now back to the show. Get Dr. Van Helsing now, Seward barked to his assistant, and run. The assistant disappeared, and Seward was left alone in Renfield's room. The assistant didn't understand what happened, but Dr. Seward did. Renfield was dying, in a pool of his own blood. Someone had come into the room, beaten his face until his skull fractured, and then broken his neck. Renfield had been behind a locked door, and the assistant didn't understand how this could possibly be self-inflicted. Seward, however, knew that it was not. Renfield was dying, but Van Helsing had the same idea as Seward. He had returned with his surgery kit. Arthur and Quincy arrived in their pajamas to see the doctors laying the injured patient out on his bed. Within minutes, Van Helsing had removed the blood clot, but the man was still hemorrhaging. Renfield didn't have long. He gasped and begged for water. Dr. Seward brought him brandy. Flies. He gave Renfield flies. Big fat ones. The spiders, too. He had promised Renfield life. Life through the ages. And so Renfield had let him in. The patient started to weep. Mina. He had invited the count in, and now Mina. He had seen her that afternoon. She was different. Now, she was his. Renfield had the strength that the count had given him. So, when the count visited that night, sliding in like a vapor on the moonlight, Renfield was ready. Renfield liked Mina, and he didn't want the count to take more life. Not hers. So Renfield attacked the count as soon as the thing took form in his room. It wasn't even a fight. The count beat him against the floor a half a dozen times and then snapped his neck. Renfield knew he was dying as he watched his own blood flow out onto the floor. He chuckled. There was life in the blood. Renfield died quickly after that, and Van Helsing ran from the bed. Hey, we should knock, right? I mean, they're a newly married couple and the door is probably locked for a reason and... Ooh, okay, you're just going to kick it in. Back up, everyone, Seward recommended, as Van Helsing lined up his foot and annihilated the door. Oh yeah, and not only is he a doctor, lawyer, professor, and folklore aficionado, but he's also pretty ripped. Van Helsing stepped over the splinters, and he found himself looking straight at him. The count stood over Mina. A smile appeared amidst all the blood on his face. Jonathan was in a trance on the bed, but Mina was sitting up against the pillows. The count had his shirt open, and Mina drinking his blood? The count's eyes burned with fury. He took one step toward Van Helsing, and he stopped. The smile faded, and Dracula shook his head. He staggered backward, away from the communion wafer Van Helsing held outstretched. That was when they lost the moonlight. The room was shrouded in darkness, and it took an instant for Arthur to light his lamp. But when he did, the black vapor had left the room. Dracula was gone. The husband and wife were inconsolable. Once Mina came out of her trance, she screamed that she was unclean. She was the enemy. She could never kiss her husband again. Jonathan was undone. How could this happen to her? How could this be? He mumbled repeatedly before fainting. Then, somehow, the news got worse. There was shouting from downstairs. Fire! Seward's office was on fire. Fortunately, they were able to put it out quickly. Only a few things had been hit. The phonograph, some books, and a pile of papers. In that stack, however, had been all of their information on Dracula and Lucy. All but a single backup copy was gone. The count had burned it all, while the group comforted the husband and wife. Van Helsing tried to console Mina. The children Lucy had bitten had survived, and they hadn't been turned. She would too. But honestly, he wasn't so sure. He long suspected that the process of becoming a vampire involved more than simply the loss of blood. And now, it was confirmed. The victim had to replace their blood with that of a vampire. Truly, he didn't know how far gone Mina was. Quincy had watched the bat that took flight in the sky after Dracula left. He stood, acknowledging that all this was very sad, but they knew where he was going, and it was nearly dawn. Today was the day. They had work to do. He dove out the window, Of course he did. Van Helsing stood with a steak in one hand and garlic in the other. This was the second house in Piccadilly. The group had hired a locksmith. Well, Arthur, aka Lord Godalming, had hired a locksmith. No one would question his honor. A lord certainly didn't need to break into someone's house. A policeman even tipped his hat to Arthur while the locksmith illegally and unwittingly opened the door. Inside, there were the boxes. There had been 12 at the first address. At the second, Van Helsing had just finished counting when they heard the noise at the door. It was a boy with a telegram from Mina. She had been watching from the window. Dracula had left Carfax, and he was coming for them. After gaining entry to the second property, Arthur and Quincy had left straight for the asylum. Dracula had now left Carfax, so they took all the wafers they had and sealed the estate. When the Count inevitably went to one of his homes in Piccadilly, it would either be the one they just sealed, or it would be the one in which Seward, Jonathan, and Van Helsing waited. And yeah, Dracula could move around during the day. He was just powerless, just like a super strong normal human with normal human weaknesses. But he wasn't without his strengths. Though Van Helsing had positioned the team strategically around the room, the Count was expecting them. As soon as they heard steps in the hallway, it was too late. He was in the room. Jonathan brandished a massive, curved knife that he borrowed from Van Helsing and slashed out at the man who tried to steal his wife, who had tried to take his entire life. The Count was surprised to see Jonathan, and even more surprised to see the knife coming for him. He ducked back just in time, and the knife slashed through his jacket, spilling gold and banknotes on the floor. Seward stepped forward, clutching a crucifix and wafer in one hand and a knife in the other. There was a look of terror on the Count's face as it transformed from pale white to a sickly green. He looked with hate to the three men as they closed in on him. Unfortunately for them, they were backing him toward the corner with a window. The Count saw his one and only exit and, in one motion, rolled and picked up what money he could before diving straight through the glass. As everyone does when they're super confident in winning, Dracula rose to his feet and shouted at the men up in the window, saying that he saw them, their pale faces in a row, like sheep at a butcher. Time was on his side. He had centuries, and he had places he could go in England, and he had taken the women they loved. Soon, Mina would turn, and through her, he would feed on all of them. He rushed off through the quickly forming crowd on the street and disappeared. Van Helsing gritted his teeth and nodded. Good. The Count was scared. And he was wrong. He didn't have places he could hide in England. He had a place. There were 8 boxes in the room, where there should have been 9. So Dracula had one place left to hide. But they had his money, his papers, and the deeds to his properties. Van Helsing scooped them all up and announced that it would soon be dark. They had to get back to the asylum. To Mina. The men sat eating ravenously. They hadn't eaten all day, and after last night, they felt like they could finally rest. It was a success. They had driven Dracula from all but one of his hiding places. Mina now had their full confidence. They had been wrong to cut her out of things, and if she had been with them, maybe she wouldn't have been in danger. If they were going to do this together, they needed to be together. One of the side effects of Mina having their full confidence, though, was her knowing what Dracula said after he jumped out the window, that it was inevitable that Mina would turn, and then turn on all of them. As the men ate, Mina couldn't keep it in any longer. She had to ask something of them. If it came to it, if she turned, they needed to do it. She wouldn't put them at risk. She wouldn't put the man she loved in danger. She held up a hand, stopping Jonathan's objections. What they had done for Lucy was a kindness, and she wanted that same kindness, should the worst happen to her. Tearfully, Jonathan nodded, and so did the rest of the group. Van Helsing sighed and averted his eyes. That night, after Van Helsing had sealed Mina's room and assured her and Jonathan that it was safe, Mina dreamt. She awoke with a start and went to Van Helsing's room. she had been on a boat. All the men sat around a table, listening to Mina. She had been surrounded by dirt in a coffin. She was so still, yet so strong, rocking back and forth, listening to the muffled sound of waves lapping against the side of the boat. Quincy shrugged. So what? It was a dream. Van Helsing shook his head. No, it wasn't. The Count's blood ran in Mina's veins, which meant he had an influence over Mina. But that influence worked two ways. It was doubtful that the Count was even aware of it. He had likely never failed to turn someone once he started. Moreover, it meant something else. The Count was running. He only had one box left. No money and no property. And people in England were hunting him. Arthur piped up. This was great news. They did it. They won. But Van Helsing continued. All he had to do was go home and sleep. He could sleep for a century if he wanted to, but 40 years should do it. Van Helsing would be dead, and the rest of the crew would be in their late 60s, memory of Dracula seeming like a fairy tale of their youth. Until one night, when a mist filtered in through an open window, and the ageless, immortal Count picked them off one by one, and then took England once they were dead. The group fell silent. Van Helsing said that the Count played the long game. It was unlikely that they were the first to oppose him, though they might be the first to make him flee. Van Helsing took a deep breath. They weren't the first, but they would be the last. He knew where the Count was going. He was going home, to the one place he thought he would be safe. But they would come for him and put an end to all of it, so he would never plague a future generation. Arthur, Seward, and Quincy nodded in agreement. Jonathan and Mina were less excited. Mina was feeling weak. Jonathan was terrified. He didn't want to go back to Transylvania. Van Helsing sighed. He was afraid they had less of a choice than anyone. The Count was immortal, but Mina was not. She was fighting it, but like Van Helsing had said, Dracula's blood ran in her veins now. If they didn't stop him, then, at best, she would likely die. And worst, Jonathan asked the professor. Van Helsing sighed again. At worst, she would become one of them, and they would need to honor her wishes and put a stake through her heart. Jonathan caught Mina as she fainted. Mina could barely keep her eyes open as she felt the scar on her forehead. It had been a test. A test to see how far gone she was. When Van Helsing was preparing her room one night, he touched the consecrated communion wafer to her forehead, and it burned her like it would have burned the Count or Lucy had they touched one. She was turning into one of them. She was unclean. At this point, Mina could barely rise from her bed. They had been waiting in Varna, Bulgaria for a week. It was the same port Dracula had sailed from 3 months earlier, and it was where his ship was headed now. The next day, after Mina's dream when she was on a boat, Arthur and Quincy had headed down to the docks. It wasn't long before they learned of a tall, pale man in a cut coat throwing money around, trying to ship a box to Varna. Van Helsing and his friends had just missed the ship, but they could still make it. If they took the Orient Express, they could arrive in Varna in mere days before the Count, board his ship, and kill him before he even rose from his coffin. Mina refused to be left behind, and she was right to come along. Her dreams told them when the Count was still on the water. Unfortunately, they also told the Count where Mina was. Arthur entered their room and pulled Jonathan out. At Mina's request, they hadn't told her the details of the trip, but the train must have been enough. Arthur had just received a telegraph from his office, which had been watching for the ship's arrival. Dracula knew they were coming, and his ship had changed course and sailed on to Galati in eastern Romania. He had given them the slip. They took the next train to Galati that afternoon. Mina stopped hearing water in her dreams, which meant Dracula had made it to land. And they needed a new plan. His name was Petrov Skinsky, and he was dead. Quincy had taken Mina to the hotel in Glotti. The American was the only one who didn't speak any foreign languages. The rest went to follow the paper trail. First, they talked to the captain of the Tsarina. The ship Dracula had boarded in England. He chatted about the box, and about how, as he picked up more and more passengers on their way to Romania, the more people on board wanted to throw it overboard. But the captain had refused, and when they reached port, he handed the cargo over to a guy named Hildesheim. He was an attorney in town. Dracula had him on retainer even before leaving Transylvania. He had arranged for the head of a work troop, Mr. Petrov Skinsky, to take the box from the ship before dawn to avoid customs. Van Helsing and the others searched for Skinsky, and they found him in the graveyard. His throat had been ripped out in the early hours of the morning before it was light. They returned to the hotel and found Mina awake with a map spread out in front of her. She had a plan. There were three ways for the Count to get back home: road, rail, and water. None were great, and, thanks to Mina, he knew he was being hunted. Water was the best bad option, however, and the use of the late Mr. Skinsky helped confirm that. According to Jonathan's journals, Dracula regularly employed the workers who traded downriver. Jonathan took her into his arms and kissed her. The others celebrated her acumen. Mina rolled her eyes. There wasn't any time for that. Here's what they needed to do. Mina and Van Helsing took a train west. It took a lot of convincing to get Mina away from Jonathan, but Van Helsing assured the man that his route was the safest. While Jonathan and Arthur bought a boat and looked for the boat on the river, Seward and Quincy would ride ahead, hoping to catch it before it made landfall. Mina and Van Helsing would be going ahead, traveling to Castle Dracula to seal the estate once and for all. It was actually the safest place, Van Helsing reasoned, because Dracula was in transit. Mina watched the wild country fly past her carriage. They had left from Bistrice, just like Jonathan, following the same trail he had written about mere months ago while he crossed those lands. Now, the first snows were beginning to fall. Off in the distance, wolves began to howl. Van Helsing tapped Mina on the shoulder and pointed to his pocket watch. It was midnight. November 1st, actually, and it was time to switch. Mina handed him the reins, and she went to the back. She didn't need him to tell her to sleep, like he did when they started out. The only issue was the dreams. When she closed her eyes, she was in the box, hearing creaking and people laughing and talking all around her. She heard the oars on the water. They pressed on, more and more space passing between homes. People ran inside as the carriage thundered past. "Stop!" Mina yelled on the afternoon of the 4th. The carriage came to a halt. "Here." She pointed up a sandy road that disappeared into the mountains. This was it. This was where Jonathan had stopped between Bistrice and Bukovina on that fateful night. It, Castle Dracula, was up that road. They rode, and when nightfall came, Van Helsing started to have a feeling. He slowed the carriage to a halt. They weren't safe. Van Helsing built a fire and told Mina to sit by it. He pulled out an envelope of communion wafers and dutifully crushed them. Mina seemed to wince as he got close, and Van Helsing finished his wide circle around the fire. Then he asked Mina to cross it. She refused. It hurt even to think about it, let alone get close. Van Helsing breathed deeply. Good. If she couldn't cross it, neither could they. Mina turned to her friend. They? Van Helsing gripped the remaining wafers, and he looked out on the darkness of the forest. The snow fell thick, and Van Helsing wrapped Mina in more furs. Snowflakes hissed on the fire, but Van Helsing built it taller. Then, through the moonlight and the snow, they saw the eyes. Three pairs. Moving toward them, they smiled, and their sharp white teeth glinted in the moonlight. But they stopped on the edge of the circle, recoiling. Like Mina, they couldn't cross it. Van Helsing breathed. They were safe. "Come, sister. Come to us," the women chanted. Mina sat there trembling. They turned their gaze on Van Helsing, but only found a stake, a pack of communion wafers, and his steely gaze staring back at them. The vampire sneered. Like Dracula, they played the long game. They could wait out this old man. They just had to make sure he couldn't leave. Van Helsing covered Mina's eyes, but they still heard the cry of the horses. When at last he uncovered them, the women were gone, and the night was already beginning to steal the warmth from the horses' corpses, their throats torn out, and the surrounding snow red with their blood. The next morning, Van Helsing left Mina sleeping as he crunched off in the snow. He knew it was risky, that a wolf could come. A wolf wouldn't be held back by the wafers. But if they were here, then it was close. He gripped the hammer, turned a corner, and the castle loomed up ahead. That was when he saw them. The graves. In the end, it was butcher's work, and Van Helsing didn't relish in it. He found the graves of the three young women, stuffed their mouths with garlic, and cut off their heads. He knew they didn't want this. No one wanted this. They were just like Lucy would have been, or Mina would be, if they didn't stop Dracula. For whatever reason, he had turned these three young women. They were his servants here, slaves to their hunger. Van Helsing was setting them free. At least, that's what he told himself. It wasn't without its small joys, though. There was a fourth grave there. One that simply read, Dracula. Van Helsing didn't know the story behind it. Why or how the man who became the monster originally died. But he didn't need to know. He hefted the stone lid off and placed a communion wafer in the tomb. The Count's final resting place was now forever forbidden to him. It was late afternoon when Van Helsing returned. He hadn't heard the wolves, so he climbed up the path to the castle, and he found the entrance. He sealed every door and window he could reach with a wafer. The old professor smiled as he walked down the path. The place was now forever sealed. The Count could never go home again. But as he descended the hill toward Mina, he heard gunshots. They were racing against sunset, and the entire team knew it. The Romani were galloping on the cart with a massive box in tow, but the four men were in pursuit. Seward and Quincy were in front, and Jonathan and Arthur were behind, but catching up. Each man brandished a Winchester rifle, and by the way Jonathan and Arthur were arriving, they'd soon have the cart cornered. Snow stung their faces, and Jonathan heard wolves. It brought back flashes of those terrible nights in the castle. He shook his head and spurred his horse on faster and faster. Tonight, the terror would end. They just had to catch the casket. If they didn't catch it before sunset, Dracula would reach his full power. He could fly away and hide for another century in his homeland before terrorizing again. No, they had to stop him tonight. And that's when they managed to stop the cart. They arrived at the cart at the perfect time, catching it on two sides. Guns trained on the workers, the cart slowed to a stop. The workers pointed to the sky in terror, to the setting sun, and shouted at the four, but Jonathan didn't listen. He rode up and jumped down from his horse. Before the workers had time to react, Jonathan was on the back of the carriage and kicking at the box. The lead worker saw him and barked for the five men in his employ to get out their weapons. But those on the left side of the carriage quickly dropped theirs when they saw Arthur and Dr. Seward's Winchesters trained on them. Only Quincy had problems, but even he was able to force his way through after a short scuffle. Seeing how low the sun was getting, and how Jonathan kicked the box off the carriage and onto the path, the workers backed away. Sunset was seconds away, and he would awaken again, at any moment, in full power. Jonathan and Quincy tore at the lid to the coffin, and the nails screeched as they came free. They stood over the exposed body. Seconds until sunset, when its eyes opened. Even up on the hill, slowly descending with Van Helsing, Mina could see the look of hate in those eyes. And then she saw the look turn to triumph. It was a look that told her that they were too late. But Jonathan remembered the fear he had felt upon realizing he was a prisoner in the castle. He remembered when he had learned the Count had been coming to Mina in the night, the person he loved most in the world. He had lived in fear one way or another for 6 months, and he wasn't going to die that way. He took out his long, curved knife and slashed the Count across the throat. At the same instant, Quincy jammed his own Bowie knife down in the Count's heart. There was a pause, and the look of hate changed to a smile. But it wasn't one of victory. It was one of peace. It was thankful. The Count looked on the final seconds of his final sunset and exhaled. He closed his eyes and turned to dust. It was over. Dracula was dead. The workers were already gone, booking it away from the demon or the men who killed the demon. It didn't matter. Either way, they were gone. The wolves stopped howling, too. Then, Jonathan heard a cough. Blood spurted onto Dracula's ashes. And Jonathan looked at Quincy, who collapsed into the snow. He had been stabbed in that scuffle with the peasant. But he had pressed on, helping Jonathan to open the coffin lid and stab Dracula at the last possible moment while he was still vulnerable. Now, Quincy couldn't stop the bleeding. He sputtered, but smiled as he watched Van Helsing and Mina arrive. Mina's forehead, it was clear. The wafer scar was gone. The curse had been lifted. His death would not be in vain. The six friends were silent in their bittersweet victory. Seven years later, Jonathan and Mina stood on a path overlooking the beautiful mountains. It was summer, about the time of year Jonathan had first arrived in Transylvania. It was a lot easier to find a carriage to this part of the forest this time around. The wolves had subsided, and the locals were less fearful. Jonathan and Mina looked down, still unable to comprehend the terror and the victory of that night. The castle that had once been so imposing was now a desolate waste, like a faded memory. Jonathan and Mina felt a tug at their arms and looked down. All right, they could get back on the road. Their child, nearly six, didn't know what this place meant to them. And that was great. He would never truly know what they had done for him, for the world and everyone who would come after them. And that was fine. They knew. He and Mina, Van Helsing, Arthur, and Dr. Seward. And that was enough. A gentle wind blew past, and Jonathan took his son, little Quincy, on his knee, and put his arm around Mina as they drove away from Castle Dracula for the last time. Today's episode was adapted from Dracula by Irish writer Bram Stoker. If you haven't read it, I absolutely recommend it. It's written in an epistolary style, meaning that you're reading Jonathan, Mina, Seward, and Lucy's letters and diary entries, as opposed to having a story told by a narrator. Oddly enough, as large as the novel looms in the realm of horror fiction and vampire fiction, it wasn't big in its time, and Bram Stoker died in relative poverty, with his widow having to auction off the notes for the novel for £2. It wasn't until the extremely famous 1930s movie adaptation with Bela Lugosi that the book really took off, and it's never been out of print since. Fun fact, mere days before publication, Stoker changed the title of the book to Dracula from the way less cool The Dead Undead. Another title he almost went with was Count Vampire. He made the right choice. This book is so complex and so full of themes that it is literally English Major 101 to crack this book open and write a paper on it. And I'm not joking. In my intro to the English major course I took in college, this was the book we used when learning how to write papers. It wasn't the first vampire novel, but it stands above all others as a masterpiece of the genre. Stoker spent 7 years researching for the novel, and even though nearly every culture has some form of vampire, Dracula's particular rules and vulnerabilities still stick in our heads as the prototypical vampire. This is a very relevant, kind of shameless plug, but we do another podcast called Myths and Legends, where a while back we explored the folklore behind Dracula. It's episode 50, and I'll put a link in the show notes. And if you're looking to go very in-depth, there's an excellent book called In Search of Dracula by Raymond T. McNally and Radu Florescu, where it talks about not just vampire lore, but Vlad the Impaler, the in-name-only inspiration for the Count, who somehow lived a far more violent and bloody life. That's it for this week's episode. It was written by me, Jason Weiser, and edited by Carissa Weiser. Our theme song is by Breakmaster Cylinder, and there are links to more music in the show notes. Next week, we're getting back into Shakespeare, so keep an eye out for that one. Thank you so much for listening, and I'll see you next time.